Frank Ling.
And I'm Charles Lee.
And you're listening to the Grok Science Show.
That's right. It's a weekly look at the world of science, technology, and their effects on our daily lives. Coming up on today's program, Kate Sukel will join us to discuss Dirty Minds.
So stay tuned for all of this.
Plus the Grokatron 5000.
And our world-famous question a week.
Coming right up.
Here.
On the Grok's
Science Show.
Science Show. Well, we all know what love is, or at least we think we do. But what actually goes on in our brains when we love someone? Well, in Dirty Minds, the acclaimed science writer Kate Sukel delves into the latest neuroscientific research concerning love and sex to explain what chemistry really means for the way we approach our relationships. And Ms. Sukel joins us today to discuss her book, Dirty Minds, How Our Brain Influences Love, Sex, and Relationships. Ms. Sukel, thank you very much for joining us today on the Grok's Science Show.
Thank you. Please call me Kate.
All right. This is really a fascinating book that you've written here, Dirty Minds, in which you look at the neuroscience of love and sex and everything in between there. What inspired you to write this book?
This is the sad sack part of the story. I actually got divorced. And while, of course, every friend has that book that you need to read when you're having love troubles, that one book that fixed everything for them, I waded through a bunch of different tomes and didn't find anything that worked. So because my background is in neuroscience and I know that the brain is the seat of all behavior, I thought maybe there's something more compelling and maybe something that can explain my situation a little better in the scientific literature.
I see. So the soft psychological approaches really were somewhat lacking then.
I think that they were lacking, but also they hint at science, but they don't really tell you what it means. For example, you know, John Gray, the Mars-Venus guy, he actually sells brain chemistry supplements on his website now. And in one of his books, he said something to the effect of, well, if this approach doesn't work for you, then it may be that if you're a woman, you have too much testosterone. And I thought, what's too much testosterone? I mean, I'm not growing a mustache or, you know, having anything to send between my legs. So obviously I must still be pretty girly. So what does that mean? What is the right level of these neurochemicals? How do these chemicals work? That was the stuff that I wasn't really getting from a lot of the self-help books that are already out there.
And did you find that there are specific chemicals, specific pathways that are involved in love and falling in love?
Definitely. In fact, love is a complex cocktail of neurochemicals that includes things like dopamine, which is a feel-good neurotransmitter, oxytocin, which is, of course, in the news all the time these days. It's called the cuddle chemical, and it promotes trust and also maternal behavior. Vasopressin, which is a neurochemical that's been linked to monogamous behaviors. And then also things like serotonin, neurotrophins, which are scientists like to call them brain fertilizer because they help with neurogenesis and keeping your brain cells healthy. There's really a lot going on that not only changes your risk and reward processing circuitry, but really promotes those heady physical feelings you have when you fall in love with somebody.
So why are these chemicals released in some situations and not others?
Oh, if only we knew. The person that figures that out is going to make one heck of a pill that people are going to line up to buy. But, you know, there is something interesting about the fact that our neurochemistry is so complicated, and then all of a sudden you add in another person, and then the two of them together, you know, of course, it's just exponential at that point. What we do know at this point is that attraction, at least initially, it's not just physical. It comes down to our pits, our armpits. Each of us have a unique odor print, like our, you know, fingerprint or the iris in our eye. Nobody has an odor quite like us. And our brains are very adept at picking up the chemosensory signals from that odor print and assessing whether somebody would be a good partner or not. So it's assumed or, you know, that there's something in that odor print that really speaks to you and can give you that crazy in love type of feeling.
Is it that we're looking for somebody more like us, less like us? What's the signal?
What's interesting is that we're looking for somebody with optimal compatibility. So our otoplin is actually based on our immune system genes, a series of genes called the HLA genes. And although initially scientists believed that what was most attractive was somebody who was as different as possible, and of course that fit in with these evolutionary ideas that would allow us to have offspring that had a lot of genetic variability so they could better survive in the world. But what they found instead is that actually it's optimal compatibility. There's got to be something in there that you recognize. So for women, when they smell dirty T-shirts of men that have slept in these T-shirts for 3 nights without deodorant or other fragrance agents, they find that they're most attracted to men that have sort of similar genetic profiles of their fathers. So they're different enough for healthy offspring, but close enough to be recognized. So if you found, your dad's second cousin, twice removed, a little more attractive than you thought you should at the last family reunion, that might have something to do with it.
Some of this is based on the hormones that are circulating in the body. For example, when you're pregnant, you're more inclined to like the smell of closer family relatives, whereas when you're more receptive to fertilization, that you're looking for something a little more genetically different.
That is true. Those studies have also come out. I think the important point here is that our brains, without us even being aware of it, are picking up all of these chemosensory signals about all the people around us. Because even the smell of your own baby, which is totally not sexual, is really compelling. So smell, even though we, may not be as important to us as, say, rats, still plays a really, really important part in those that we keep close to us and those that we want to keep close to us.
So humans don't rely on pheromones.
Well, of course, pheromone is a highly contested word because they have not yet discovered a human pheromone. But that doesn't mean that we don't react to chemosensory signals. It may be that our brains have evolved that it's not just a single molecule that compels us. There are lots and lots of molecules together. There's a mixed message, so to speak, that we're picking up. Or it could be that we just haven't figured out how pheromone processing works in the human brain because we don't have the same kind of smell organs that lower order mammals do. It's an ongoing debate. And while I would not use the term pheromone, I do think that those chemosensory signals are very, very important.
Really, how does the human brain differ from that of other mammals in terms of love?
Well, it's interesting that so many of the studies, especially on monogamy and parenting behaviors, are done on mammals, a specific type of mammal called the prairie vole. It's a small little mouse type animal that sort of happily burrows in gardens across the Midwest. But they happen to be socially monogamous and alloparental. And a lot of the assumptions we have about human behavior are based on the study of these little guys. So we differ in a lot of ways. We don't have a vomeronasal nasal organ, which was that little organ I was telling you about that helps process pheromones in pigs and these small animals. We have much more developed frontal lobes that allow us morality, judgment, decision-making. But a lot of the same circuitry, this risk and reward processing circuitry that's involved in love, that's involved in social behaviors, is actually quite similar.
Is this why feelings of love are so primal, if you will?
Yes. And in fact, I think one of the other reasons why it's so hard to have control is that love is sort of nature's blueprint for addiction. We learn primarily as a species from reward-based learning. We go out in the world, we do something that gives us something good, some good food to eat, some snuggles, a fun ride, and we want to do it again. And so we learn, so we can do that again. But there are things that can happen in the environment that sort of trigger up that risk and reward processing circuitry. So all of a sudden the rewards become much greater than the risks, or we at least see the rewards as being much greater than the risks. And so some scientists have actually argued that these love systems, sort of these natural circuits in, the reptilian parts of our brain, have actually been hijacked by drugs of abuse. And that's why we see these addiction problems that we do. Love is just sort of naturally addictive, and otherwise we might not do it again.
It certainly keeps the species going.
Exactly, which is kind of important, when you think about it. We have to keep having babies.
Obviously, humans, probably other animals as well, there's an interaction between our genes and our environment. How much does really makeup or growing up environment shape the neural circuitry of love?
So much in science, particularly social science, has been framed. These debates have been framed within nature and nurture. How much is hereditary? How much is environment? But the new field of epigenetics is actually showing that we need to throw away that discourse altogether. It's not one or the other. There is no biology without environment. The two are really just intertwined, and to study any behavior, you really have to understand both. So the epigenome is sort of this, it's best to think of it sort of as the software of a computer. If your genome is the hardware, the epigenome is the software. And what it's doing is it's telling the hardware how and when it should run. Specifically letting genes know when and how much of a particular protein that it should make. And what we're finding is that the littlest things in our environment can set up that epigenome. It can determine what genes are expressed, when they're expressed, how much, in what situation. And so really the idea of trying to say, okay, this is nurture or this is nature, really becomes impossible. The two are just tied and there's no untethering them.
One other issue that often comes up in the popular culture is if there are actually differences between male and female brains in terms of love.
Yes, and of course, we have a lot of stereotypes about that. And of course, women are supposed to want these, stable, monogamous relationships where their husband comes home and helps take care of the kids, he's the provider, and men are supposed to want to, spread their seed wherever. The neuroscience, it's a great evolutionary argument, especially when you look at the number of sperm versus the number of eggs, which is billions and billions versus, roughly 350 eggs over the course of the normal female's lifetime. But it's hard to, discuss sexual behaviors and, these kind of social behaviors without the context of environment. And a lot of the new studies are showing that a lot of the stereotypes we've had about what men and women want from interpersonal relationships are not what we thought. Women are more likely to say that they most recently had an orgasm with a novel partner. Women who are going through menopause, the greatest predictor about whether they're still sexually active is not whether or not they have certain hormone levels, but whether they have a new partner. Men, when they answer questions about why they have sex, rate because they want to be in a relationship as high as women do. So it's really difficult to tease out these differences. Of course, if we look strictly at the brain, there are different circuits in the brain that are sexually dimorphic. So the same way that we have different things going on, in our pants, we have some different things going on in our brains. Unfortunately, people have taken that think that different means better or smarter, which is not the case. In fact, Geert de Vries, who's a researcher at University of Massachusetts at Amherst, argues that these differences may be there to bring our behaviors closer together. But it's clear that, there's a lot more we need to learn. There are definite differences, but they don't mean better or smarter.
Besides, obviously, the reproductive aspects of sex, it's certainly very pleasurable. You certainly made a bit of splash in the internet world when you had sort of your own adventures with this particular realm of sex.
Yes. Well, the truth is that we don't know a whole lot about pleasure in, animals or humans at this point. It's assumed that there is some kind of pleasure in the animal world or else they wouldn't keep doing it. Of course, it's really hard to get your average rat to answer a questionnaire about whether it was the best orgasm of his life. But what's great is that we're now starting to do more comprehensive research about pleasure, including the female orgasm, in the neuroscience world. And as part of that, I volunteered my own orgasm to a research lab at Rutgers University who scanned my brain as I self-stimulated to orgasm. It was really kind of interesting for me because I volunteered to do it after I interviewed the lead researcher, Barry Komisarek, and I just really couldn't wrap my head around you know, what these women were doing, how it could be done in an MRI scanner, what the results really meant, and how applicable they were. And so really the only thing to do so that I didn't just sort of regurgitate the same things that have been said about his work is to volunteer myself. Despite thinking that my brain might completely dematerialize at the point of orgasm, in fact, they found that over 30 discrete areas of the brain were activated. It really is sort of a whole brain experience, a lot like an epileptic seizure. And, you know, although I think it's important just to understand, you know, normal sexual function, because we don't know that much about it in the brain yet, and it may help women that have anorgasmia, it may also help researchers better understand the brain and pleasure and how it processes pleasure, thinking, and it may, you know, give us insights to novel treatments for pain or for anhedonia, which is, you know, a big symptom in depression and some other mood-related disorders.
So does it activate a lot of the same centers that one experiences in normal pleasure just to a greater degree, or is it just more areas of the brain?
Probably to a greater degree. The thing is, you know, we do a lot of research on pain and what causes pain and differences in pain levels, but there hasn't been a lot of focus done on pleasure. So I don't know that we could actually say whether there are more or less. Certainly, it does light up the brain more than food. It lights up the brain, of course, you know, we all have different ideas about what's pleasurable with food. It lights up the brain more than a lot of other pleasurable activities, but it hasn't been looked at in a really systematic way. Okay, so what's more pleasurable, this or that, and what does the activation of these brain areas mean? The orgasm is something that is very unique. I mean, it really does light up the brain like a Christmas tree. It floods it with blood, and that may be sort of, you know, a secondary side effect of it. It may be something that's very good for you because it's bringing all of these brain areas, all that nice oxygenated blood, and helps keep the tissue healthy for longer. But the truth is we still need to do a lot more work before we know for certain.
Certainly anyone who's been in love or fallen in love has experienced the fact that there's this large heady sensation early on in the relationship, which generally tapers off over time.
Well, what some researchers in Italy have found is that at first, of course, yeah, boom, you know, there are all these neurochemicals that raise right up. Testosterone, actually, in both men and women, go way up. You see oxytocin, you see dopamine. But then over time, these levels sort of level off. And, you know, on one hand, that's probably a good thing, because if you were in that crazy love haze all the time, you may not ever leave the house. You may never not, you mean, you know, your productivity is going to be at a standstill. So it may be that naturally we want sort of that passionate love to transfer into a more companionate love, so you can focus on other things like the raising of children and, you know, maybe keeping a roof over your head. But there are couples who claim to be passionately in love even after dozens of years together. And when their brains are scanned, they look exactly like the brains of people who are newly in love. So for some people, those feelings stay. Why? We're still trying to, you know, sort of sort that out. And of course, you know, it may not be the best thing that those levels stay that way. It's an interesting question, and I think that these researchers definitely want to look more into it.
Your investigations of the neuroscience of love, what was really the thing that struck you the most as far as being odd, or the biggest kind of message you got regarding how the brain is wired for love?
The two biggest things that came to me were, you know, as a society, especially American society, and especially American women, we're bombarded with these messages that if you do this, not that, you can find and keep love. You have to follow these rules, these guidelines, and your behavior has to be a certain way, or you will be a old, lonely spinster for the rest of your life. And the science really isn't bearing that out. We're all very unique. There is a lot of variability in what's considered normal love and sexual behaviors. And I think that's something to be embraced, because so often, you know, a lot of these books and articles are out there to make us feel bad, and the science just doesn't back that up. I think the other thing that just really struck me was, of course, you know, science had gotten around to the idea, okay, it's not nature or nurture, but they still sort of saw it as a seesaw with one side dipping, you know, as being more important than the other. And epigenetics is really changing the way that we look at so many behaviors, and, you know, things that happen in utero, in early childhood, really can shape the way that you interact with other people for the rest of your life. And that includes, you know, how receptive to sex you'll be, how early you'll become sexually mature, you know, whether you'll have multiple partners or be more monogamous. And I think that's fascinating. A lot of the stereotypes we have about relationships, I think science is going to upend them, and it's going to be interesting to see what the cultural fallout is going to be.
Well, it really is a fascinating subject, a fascinating book. The book, again, is called Dirty Minds, How Our Brains Influence Love, Sex, and Relationships. And Ms. Kate Sukel, I want to thank you very much for joining us today on the Grok Science Show.
Thank you.
All right. If you have a few seconds, we would like to quickly play our game, the Grokatron 5000.
Sounds good.
Okay. Well, it's time to play our game. It's called the Grokatron 5000. It is our supercomputer, formerly known as Deep Blue. And today, the Grokatron 5000 has chosen the topic, dirty or clean. So, for the following five individuals, the Grokatron 5000 would like to know if you think they're dirty or clean, however you want to interpret that, and maybe a little reason why. Ms. Sukel, ready to play the game?
I am ready.
Okay, here we go. Dirty or clean, person number one, it's the real estate mogul, Donald Trump.
Oh, dirty, I guess. He's had a lot of wives, so I think that probably he's a little dirty.
Probably also in his real estate dealings, too, but I'm not sure about that.
We'll have to ask the IRS about that one.
Right.
Yeah. Not my area of expertise.
All right, number two, it's golfer Tiger Woods.
Oh, definitely dirty. I saw some of those text messages when he was outed as a serial philanderer. He is a dirty, dirty boy.
Number three, Dr. Ruth Westheimer.
Actually, that's really hard. I'm going to say dirty, but in the best possible way. She is, you know, an icon. She's incredible. And, you know, I think that what's great, and actually I'm going to change my answer. I'm going to go with clean, because even though she's all about sex and education, she keeps things very real, very personal, very educational. So, yeah, she's great.
All right. Number four, Oprah Winfrey.
Ooh, that's hard. Again, I'm going to go with clean just because she does such a great job of making people sort of embrace themselves and their inner selves. So I'll go with clean, although I bet she has a little bit of a dirty streak. We just don't know about it.
All right. And finally, number five, it's the President of the United States, Barack Obama.
Oh, I'm going to go with clean just because I really don't know how to go there. I don't want to think too much about the president's sex life either way, as much as so many political candidates want to get into our sex lives. I'm just going to take the high road and say clean.
All right. Well, Ms. Sukel, I want to thank you very much for joining us today on the Grok Science Show and, of course, talking about your new book, Dirty Minds, How Our Brains Influence Love, Sex, and Relationships. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you. It was a lot of fun.
And that's all for this week's edition of the Grok Science Show.
Make sure you tune in next week for more from the world of science and technology.
If you'd like to contact us here, you can email us at science@groks.net. For Grok Science, I'm Frank Ling.
And I'm Charles Lee. Make sure you also see us on the web at www.groks.net. Have a great afternoon and keep on grokking. We'll be right back.